This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The deadly airstrike killed 53 refugees and migrants, and it injured more than 130 others. Most were from sub-Saharan Africa.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details next. Also, Kenya's finance minister denies fraud-related charges. Clashes between police and the country's main Shiha group kills several people in Nigeria. And climate change and population growth is affecting Africa's traditional ways of life. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the UN Refugee and UN Migration Agencies have welcomed a decision by European states to end the arbitrary detention of refugees and migrants in Libya. During a meeting yesterday in Paris, interior and foreign ministers from several European countries also committed to preventing loss of life on the Mediterranean Sea. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The ministerial meeting was triggered by the July 5th bombing of the Tajoura detention center on the outskirts of the Libyan capital, Tripoli. The deadly airstrike killed 53 refugees and migrants, and it injured more than 130 others. Most were from sub-Saharan Africa. The UN Refugee Agency says the agreement hammered out by the European states is a positive first step. But it says there is a long way to go before this situation is resolved. The UNHCR says refugees and migrants in detention are at risk of abuse, maltreatment, and even death, as the events in Tajoura show. Agency spokesman Charlie Yaxley says no one should be returned to detention centers in Libya after being intercepted or rescued at sea.
At the moment, most of the refugees and migrants who were brought back to Libya are done so after being rescued or intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard. Well, while that arbitrary detention of people after being rescued by the Libyan Coast Guard continues, then conditionalities should be put for any state support to the Coast Guard until that stops.
Yaxley says the UNHCR is concerned that search and rescue operations are increasingly left to non-governmental organizations or commercial vessels. He says that needs to change. He tells VOA an EU state search and rescue operation similar to programs seen in recent years is needed.
In terms of the NGOs, I mean, we've called on Italy to reconsider their latest proposals that would in effect criminalize search and rescue operations. I mean, saving lives in distress at sea, you know, has been a pillar of the law of the sea for centuries. It's a moral obligation, but also a fundamental legal obligation under international maritime law.
In late June, the German captain of a ship carrying 53 rescued migrants was arrested at the Italian port of Lampedusa. Italy's right-wing interior minister, Matteo Salvini, had barred her from docking. After drifting at sea for nearly 2 weeks under increasingly desperate conditions, she decided to disobey the minister's orders. A judge later overturned the arrest, saying she had acted to save lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenya's finance minister today denied fraud-related charges over contracts for the construction of two dams. Henry Rotich and 15 other officials appeared in court a day after they were arrested for their alleged roles in awarding contracts and payments to the Italian firm CMC di Ravenna. The court in Nairobi granted Rotich and his co-defendants bail pending trial. Kenya also has charged an executive of the company and is seeking his extradition from Italy. The company denies wrongdoing. 28 people have been charged in the case, but not all appeared in court today. Prosecutors allege the officials conspired to defraud the government in the building of two dams in the country's west. They say no construction work has started despite millions of dollars already spent. Rotich is the first sitting minister to be arrested on corruption charges in Kenya. President Uhuru Kenyatta has made fighting corruption a key part of his government. Islamic State insurgents have killed seven leaders of the Tuareg ethnic group in southwestern Niger over the past 3 months as a part of a strategy to create chaos in the region. The African Union has warned that about 6,000 ISIS fighters could return from Syria to Africa. Experts think the ISIS returnees could provide critical reinforcement to terrorist groups in the Sahel area. Patrick Danlevy, senior fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the imminent threat of ISIS in Africa and what should be done to counter it.
I think the threat is extremely serious based on several facts. We know that somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 individuals from the countries of Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, and Egypt have gone over to fight with ISIS both in Iraq and Syria. When those groups return, they will be hardened, combat-experienced soldiers who will be able to disrupt the stability in those particular countries that I mentioned. So I think it's an extremely serious threat, and that I think North Africa is facing the same problem that Europe is, in that they're not quite sure what to do with returning ISIS soldiers. Do they try to rehabilitate them? Do they incarcerate them in prisons? So I think the threat only grows as time goes by.
Over the past 3 months, Islamic State insurgents killed seven leaders of the Tuareg ethnic group in Niger, trying to create political void in that region. What do you make of that?
I think that that's typical of what ISIS and other radical Islamic groups are trying to do, their strategies. The Tuareg people are approximately 2 million, and they're spread over areas in North Africa, in Mali, in Niger, Libya, Algeria, Chad. Now, when you kill ethnic leaders, you promote instability in the area, and then ISIS will try to move in and replace that instability with their laws, a radical form of Sharia law. And I think that's exactly what they're attempting to do, create instability in a group of people that approximately covers 5 countries.
So what should the United States and the G5 joint force do to encounter this looming threat?
There's several things I think that the United States and G5 have to do if they're going to help the countries in North Africa. One, obviously, is to provide training for their military forces on counterterrorism. The other thing that I think that they have to do is to somehow create instability between the 4 radical terrorist groups that mainly operate in Africa. One is ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, and Boko Haram. If the U.S. and the G5 forces can somehow get those 4 groups to fight amongst themselves, that will weaken each one of the groups and it will weaken the threat. The other thing is what's been going on is in the refugee camp in Syria, Al-Hol refugee camp, ISIS has actually been taking over the refugee camp. They raised the flag there. They're beginning to try to organize and set up communications between its members so that when they leave this refugee camp and return to their countries in North Africa, they will still be able to communicate with each other, much the same way ISIS did it formerly in Camp Buka in Iraq.
So other than counter-terrorism military aspect, what should be done to deal with poor governance, corruption, lack of economic opportunities, and other factors contributing to expanded recruitment by terrorist groups in Africa?
Of all, in that we talk about using training for military, and we talk about coming up with counterterrorism techniques, but in reality, corruption and poverty produces discontent between the people. And when there's discontent, then other groups are able to exploit that discontentment and that poverty to recruit more young individuals to radical extremism. So I think there has to be some sort of economic stimulus, again, by the European, the G5, and by the United States, to put in resources that will give young people in that area a chance to look at a future where they'll have some sort of work, some sort of income, and also to root out the corruption in the government. That's going to take probably an effort maybe by the United Nations and the Security Council. That would be my thoughts.
That was Patrick Dunleavy, Senior Fellow at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. 15 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Tibor Naj, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, says the United States and its trader partners in Africa are starting to think about new ways to expand trade between the U.S. and the African continent. Naj and Constance Hamilton, the U.S. Trade Representative for Africa, today said the coming AGOA summit will focus on finding new ways to help the continent prosper. The African Growth and Opportunity Act, created 19 years ago to boost Africa's development and increase trade, expires in 2025. Hamilton told journalists on a telephone conference that the act has fallen short of its goals in some ways. For instance, she said the benefits have been shared unevenly among different countries.
Additionally, AGOA has not led to the trade diversification for which we originally hoped. Petroleum products continue to account for the largest portion of AGOA imports, with a 67% share. And the volume of AGOA trade remains modest. In the AGOA clothing sector, for example, we get about $1 billion per year from Africa, but that's just roughly 1% of the United States' $95 billion imports in global clothing imports.
Despite AGOA's flaws, Naj stressed that AGOA and other U.S. programs such as Prosper Africa continue to focus on Africa's economic development.
And for providing jobs for what we have termed Africa's emerging youth tsunami. Because as we have said before, all those millions of young people, what they really want, what they really need are jobs, jobs, and good jobs.
To continue meeting those goals, they said discussions have begun on possible ways to replace AGOA. Hamilton said among the options are separate free trade agreements with different African nations or economic blocs.
The program is scheduled to expire. That's about 6 years. 6 years in trade terms is a nanosecond. That's going to go by really quickly. That's why we're starting the conversations now with our partners to talk about what comes next. We do think that a free trade area agreement builds on the success of AGOA.
The AGOA summit runs August 4th through the 6th in Abidjan. Security was high in Nigeria's capital Abuja today, a day after several people were killed in clashes between police and the country's main Shia group. A reporter for the channel's television network was among those killed in Abuja yesterday. At least 11 members of the Shia group were killed by police gunfire, according to the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, IMN. Police officials say an officer was killed and two were injured. Witnesses said the violence yesterday broke out after protesters threw gasoline bombs and rocks at police who fired back with guns. The IMN has held a series of protests urging the government to release the Shia cleric, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. He and many others Shias were arrested in a military raid on the group's headquarters in 2015. Hundreds are reported to have died in that raid. The government says Zakzaki wants an Iranian-style Islamic revolution in secular Nigeria. But Shias say they are being persecuted by Nigeria's larger Muslim group, the Sunnis. The effects of climate change and population growth on Africa's traditional ways of life are far-reaching. For example, in Burkina Faso and Chad, the natural signs herders have used for centuries to predict rainfall and move their cattle are changing rapidly. The expansion of agriculture to accommodate growing populations also affects the migratory routes pastoralists use between arid zones and wetlands. A UNICEF-funded project called Climate Frontlines is helping to mitigate these changes by bringing pastoralists together with climate scientists and policymakers to adapt to a warming world through new maps and other tools. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Elizabeth Ilbudonibie, an anthropologist and human ecologist of Columbia University's Earth Institute.
The goal of the project is actually to promote the integration of indigenous knowledge in climate negotiations and national adaptation plans. Usually, indigenous knowledge, local knowledge, is usually viewed as obsolete and archaic, and people tend to neglect it and give more importance to climate science. But as researchers, and especially as an anthropologist, we believe that both type of knowledge can actually go hand in hand.
So are you saying that you actually value traditional knowledge? It's not something to be dismissed.
Yes, that's correct. Traditional knowledge is actually based on real-time observations and experience. For example, sometimes they look at behavior of their cattle. When they go somewhere and cattle start walking back towards the home area, they know that it's time to go back home because cattle actually can sense the beginning of the rainy season. They also use plants and different types of wildlife. For example, they observe birds, and one of these birds is known locally as walia. The arrival and the departure of walia informs them on the beginning and end of the rainy season. But the thing is that right now we are at a point when the local indicators that these local communities are using are becoming less and less reliable, because sometimes a bird that was showing up in May will arrive maybe later in June.
That's the climate change aspect.
That's the climate change aspect. So these communities are more likely to listen to new type of knowledge to improve their adaptation. And the climate scientists we worked with are trying to find out what type of information they can provide to pastoralists. And they started it in Burkina Faso and in Chad. They had these meetings where pastoralist communities were actually invited, along with meteorologists and policymakers, to talk about the challenges that pastoralist communities have. And pastoralists are also willing to sit down and talk about their problems and talk about how they can contribute to common adaptation to climate change.
Can you give me an idea of how climate change has actually affected the practices of traditional herders so far?
Nowadays, with climate change, they have to travel longer distances. They have to go into areas where they were not used to going, sometimes outside the country. And because of resource scarcity, there are also more and more conflicts with local farmers. And this is not just about because of climate change. It's also because of demographic pressure. More people to feed. And also the expansion of agricultural fields. The extension of these fields is actually one of the reasons why there is less space for corridors for cattle to actually use.
So what's an actual example where climate scientists have helped traditional herders in these conflicts with other farmers, etc.? I understand mapping is a big part of your strategy.
Yes, mapping is part of it. The mechanics behind mobility are not well understood. And to better understand them, you need to know the routes that people are taking. And some of these routes are informal. So we decided to map these routes that are not officially recognized.
And this will have an impact on policy, presumably.
Exactly. That's our goal. What can the government do? Either create new routes or monitor travel along these routes and protect them and promote social peace. So when we mapped these routes, we had participatory mapping exercises with local communities, and we made them draw the routes that they take on a map. This is how we were able to import this data into a software. And this is something that we are sharing with the scientific community, because this is something that they can use in their work.
Elizabeth Ilbudonibie is an anthropologist and human ecologist with the Climate Frontlines project at Columbia University's Institute. She spoke with Adam Phillips in New York. 1.3 million Zimbabweans living with HIV and AIDS face a shortage of life-saving antiretroviral drugs after the government failed to raise adequate funds to access donor funding. Adi Gando gives us more on the story.
A petition submitted to Parliament last week by the Zimbabwe AIDS Network revealed the government failed to meet its annual contribution of US $6 million to the Global Fund. The payment would enable Zimbabwe to access US $400 million from the International Health Fund to buy antiretroviral drugs. The Global Health Fund offers grants to countries to support programs providing HIV treatment. Signatory countries are obliged to contribute a percentage of the grant value as counterpart financing. A country that defaults in its obligations sees its grant reduced by 15%. As Zimbabwe is considered a low-income country, it is required to contribute 5% of the value of the total grant as counterpart financing spaced out over several years. Taura Inyandoro is the national coordinator for the Zimbabwe AIDS Network, representing over 200 organizations in the country. He explains why the organization petitioned Parliament.
So our petition was premised on the projected art gaps in Zimbabwe. So what has been happening is, you know, because now our money is in RTGS, so we cannot procure ARVs because our money is in RTGS. You know, we already received shipments for ARVs and then lab reagents. ACWA was going to pay for those services, but they didn't pay. So we accrued a debt of $6 million. So now we can't get fresh supplies of ARVs because we have not been able then to release or to find foreign currency.
NAC is the National AIDS Council, which administers the National AIDS Fund drawn from taxpayers. The fund collects 30 million RTGS dollars annually, but is being eroded by inflation and recent changes in monetary policy. Nyandoro says if the government does not meet its obligations, people on HIV drugs face a dire situation.
What will happen is we experience a stockout. Yeah, we call that stockout. So we run out of certain drug regimens. Third line drugs, and some clients were on first line. So on second line, we are talking of over 40,000 heart clients who will be affected. You know, our drugs, you know, they come in combination, depending on where you are with your status.
There have been reports of shortages of ARVs and antibiotics in health centers around the country. The government says it has managed to pay US $2 million toward the grant.
So what we need to now see is that committee, the portfolio committee, taking action.
The Zimbabwe Health Ministry says 8,000 new patients start using ARVs each month. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the African Continental Free Trade Area is now a reality that, if successful, will create a $3.4 trillion economic bloc. A closer look at Africa's free trade agreement on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.